America has one of the world's biggest and most efficient train networks. It just mostly carries freight, not passengers. In 2021, America moved 2.2 trillion tons-kilometer. Tons-kilometer calculated by multiplying total freight tons by distance traveled. This is third most in the world behind China and Russia. And based on revenue per tons-kilometer, American freight rail is more efficient than either of those countries even before adjusting for purchasing power parity. It hadn't always been like that. In the 1970s, the American rail industry teetered on the verge of financial collapse. After a series of expensive bailouts, the American government took desperate measures and it turned the industry around. In this video, we take a look at the Staggers Act. After the American Civil War, the railroads were privately owned. The railroad companies worked hand in hand with government to seize private land for their track, fund its construction, and run their network. By 1900, America had 200,000 miles of track linking not only the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, but also the Great Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico. In these days, the railroads held monopolies on transport. The livelihood of entire towns, particularly the farmers, depended on their local railroad. It was the only way to get crops or products out to the markets. This let the railroads charge extortionate fees that hurt the farmers. Responding to their complaints, the individual states set up commissions to regulate the fees. But the railroad companies crossed multiple states, and they challenged the states' rights to regulate them. The state commissions also were captured by the rail companies, turning them corrupt. In 1886, the United States Supreme Court ruled on a case, Wabash versus Illinois, which limited the rights of states to control interstate commerce, thus laying the groundwork for the Interstate Commerce Act of 1887, signed into law by President Grover Cleveland. The act created the Interstate Commerce Commission, or ICC, the first national regulatory body in American history. The ICC's job was to crack down on bad practices and make rates, quote, reasonable and fair, end quote. But the original 1887 Act was contradictory, leaving the ICC quite weak. Then in 1904, a new energetic president named Theodore Roosevelt wanted to break the power of the railroads. He asked Congress for new laws and got the Hepburn Act of 1906. Hepburn expanded the ICC and gave the commission the power to impose maximum freight rates and get insight into the railroad's financials, among other things. But the 1906 Hepburn Act had a judicial review amendment attached to it that allowed the railroads to defeat the ICC's rulings. So in 1910, under President Taft, Congress passed Mann-Elkins. Mann-Elkins gave the ICC the ability to mandate maximum freight rates on its own initiative without recourse through the courts. It has been called the single most progressive piece of legislation in the history of American rail. Mann-Elkins levied these strict regulations on an industry that was starting to change. The big growth markets in the West were played out. Railroad tax expenses tripled from 1900 to 1915. Labor costs went from 39% of total operating revenue to 43% over the same time period. And the industry was starting to find itself increasingly reliant on debt. In 1900, railroad balance sheets were 50% funded by debt. By 1917, that had gone to two-thirds. At the same time, the advent of roads and cars, as well as air travel, broke rail's monopoly on transportation. By 1914, you could drive all the way from Utica, New York, to Chicago. 3 years later, you had 5 million cars and 400 trucks in the United States. A year after that, we had the first regular airmail route going from Washington, D.C. to New York. It did not last all that long, just about 3 months, but it was a harbinger of things to come. These new developments broke the railroad's exclusive monopoly on transport, but it was a long-term trend. In 1916, trains still moved 77% of all freight and a staggering 98% of human passengers between the cities. Throughout the 1910s, however, the railroad struggled to keep up with rising cost inflation amidst an increasingly assertive ICC. The worker unions wanted more pay, so the companies tried to pass freight rail increases, but the ICC pushed back. They denied a proposed 8 to 20% increase in 1911 and granted only a small 5% increase in 1913, far lagging the 30% increase in cost of living. The companies fell further into debt. And then war broke out in Europe. Suddenly, there was a titanic demand surge in moving weapons and supplies. In 1916, the labor unions asked again for more raises in overtime pay, which the companies did not grant, in a hope to raise a strike and break the unions' backs. What followed was a nationwide strike in disarray. When the U.S. entered World War I, the federal government wanted to get everyone working together towards the greater goal, so they nationalized the railroads for the duration of the war. The government introduced new standards, invested substantial sums into the industry, and paid the workers very well. The labor unions argued that the railroads should have stayed nationalized after the war ended. Why wouldn't they? During nationalization, wages rose 80% and employment 20% in just 3 years. By 1920, the average railway worker made 30% more than an average industrial worker just for working on the railroad. But the public was understandably largely against it. So in 1920, the railroads returned to private ownership. After World War I, the railroads somewhat revived, but the industry landscape was definitely changing. New modes of transport were starting to eat away at the trains. This included the steamboat, but more significantly, the family automobile and the Greyhound bus. These traveled on a new highway network funded by the Federal Aid Road Act of 1916. In the 1920s, the U.S. government also started funding the construction of civil airports. Pilots trained in the military crossed over, leading to the first passenger airlines. By 1929, we had American, Transworld, and United. The railroads could not respond to this competition because the rate schedules were dictated by the ICC. Any change had to be approved by the ICC, which deliberated for a long while and was reluctant to approve rate hikes. Rail rates for a certain load were not based on actual cost of carry, but rather on the load's value. So a high-value load good, like a car, had to be charged more than coal or grain, even if they weighed the same. The justification was that shippers shipping higher-value goods can afford to pay more. It kind of makes sense if you assume freight trains are a monopoly. Ramsey pricing, as it is so theoretically called, maximizes social value or whatever. But things were changing. And with the rates held at 2-3% of the rail network's invested capital, it was nowhere near enough to attract new capital to build out new rail. Imagine if the U.S. government forced rate caps on AWS or Microsoft Azure usage based on percentages of the data center's cost. Very critically, the ICC imposed rate floors, which meant that even if the railroads could cut prices to compete with these new forms of transport, they were not allowed to. The ICC's reasoning being that it gave one rail company advantages over the others. And finally, the ICC forbade easy entry or exit into the market. Companies were forced to maintain lines even if they were unprofitable and were prevented from consolidating, which would have been the best way to build scale and cut cost. All of this left the railroads with no way to invest in their lines, consolidate, or innovate so to compete with the trucking industry. In later years, the rail lines could only track their trains by installing a video camera at the yards' entrances. An outdated regulation stayed on the books long after their usefulness. For instance, a requirement to keep firemen on board long after the trains transitioned to diesel fuel. The years after World War II only double underlined these larger growth factors. The interstate highways got better, cars got cheaper, passenger airlines expanded and got safer. You had the rise of oil pipelines, as well as, most significantly, the freight truck companies. The trains steadily lost share in these years. Because of this, nearly 5,000 miles of rail lines were abandoned before 1930, and the trend only continued throughout the decades going into the 1960s. It was worse in the intercity passenger part of the market. In 1929, we had nearly 20,000 passenger trains traveling between American cities. By 1966, that fell to less than 1,000. It was not all doom and gloom for the railways. The rise of the container promised huge growth for the trains. In a prior video, I talked about how containers allowed shippers to pack and unpack away from the ports, minimizing ship load and unload time at port and bypassing the port unions. Trains took on some of this new demand for container transport, in particular demand for what is called land bridge service, where a train can take a container from one side of the United States to the other, allowing them to skip the Panama Canal. This behavior first emerged as early as the 1920s, with links connecting Chicago and St. Louis to the Atlantic Ocean. But the ICC intervened early on, mandating that these rail lines charge not by weight, but again, value of item carried. Thus, most of the freight work went to the trucks again. From 1947 to 1977, intercity freight tonnage nearly doubled. And yet, the trains carried 91% less freight in 1977 than they did in 1947. In the 1950s, the train operators started pushing for more control over their rates. By now, you started to get these creative elements like the Southern Pacific Railway running a line between San Francisco and Los Angeles within state, and then moving the goods to Arizona across state using their own trucks, thusly bypassing the ICC's interstate authority. So in 1958, Congress passed the Transportation Act of 1958, which gave the ICC the ability to loan out money and also remove their powers to dictate rates in certain times. But the industry continued to suffer. By the 1960s, America's railroad networks were falling apart, the companies unable to invest in them. It was particularly bad in the Northeast. Coal was their biggest revenue driver, and the decline of the coal industries there burned away their biggest moneymaker. Yet, as this all developed, the U.S. government refused to do anything substantial to reverse the situation. In 1970, the region's biggest railroad, Penn Central, declared bankruptcy, the largest bankruptcy in American history up until then. This finally moved the government to do something, but even then, it was the bare minimum. Congress first threw some money at it. In 1971, the U.S. government formed Amtrak, a national passenger railroad company. Amtrak took over Penn Central's unprofitable passenger train services. And then in 1976, the U.S. government basically nationalized several failing railroad networks in the Northeast, including Penn Central's, to create Consolidated Rail Corporation, or Conrail. Even as Congress funded new infrastructure for Conrail and exempted it from state taxes, the company still generated a cumulative $1.2 billion in net income losses from 1977 to 1980. It was supposed to turn its first profit in 1979, but instead lost $221 million. At the start, it had 91,000 employees and eventually had to cut 60,000 of them. The government finally sold Conrail back to private industry in 1987 for $2 billion, after sinking a cumulative $8 billion in total. After this decade of desperation, and with more railways teetering on the edge of financial insolvency, the U.S. government finally realized that it had to do something drastic. In 1980, Congressman Harley Staggers Sr. proposed the Staggers Act. Its goal was to bring in more market competition. Railroad companies received more leeway to enter or exit a rail line, and this ability to cancel unprofitable lines was particularly helpful. Additionally, the railroads were able to spin off their small track lines into smaller regional and local lines. Those lines feed into the larger interstate lines, creating a hub-and-spoke system somewhat reminiscent of the airliners. And the companies were allowed again to set their rates based on market conditions. Companies now can enter long-term contracts, which went into effect only if the ICC did not strike them down first. Staggers came amidst a larger trend in freight rail consolidation, and if there is a criticism that can be levied, it is that it could not reverse that trend. But the reality is that the 1887 and early 1910s regulations fell upon the train industry at a time when they were true monopolies. Things have changed, and the companies should now have their economic self-determination returned to them. You cannot deny the results. The Staggers Act remains the textbook example of some of the market benefits of deregulation. From 1980 to 1990, the number of containers and trailers carried by trains doubled from 3.1 to 6.1 million. This was aided by the 1977 debut of double-stacked car technology, now used in 70% of modern freight. Fueled by the massive intermodal container transport trend, intermodal rail traffic grew by 36.7% in just the first 5 years of the 1980s. In 2017, U.S. railroads carried 81% more ton-miles of freight than in 1981. Train companies were now able to quickly service new areas per market demand, introducing competition. Rail rates for certain items like wheat, soybeans, and corn fell significantly in the 5 years after the Staggers Act. For this reason, railroads carried larger market share of grains or other oil seeds in 2007 than they did in 1980, 84% compared to 53%. In many ways, it is an ideal product for them to carry. To sum it up, since Staggers, freight train rates went down, but revenue went way up because of higher volumes. Rail cars got bigger, 14% between 1980 and 1995, and trains pulled more of them. Lengths are now 36% longer. This vastly raised productivity by over 150%, raising rates of return for new rail. So now, train companies can start investing their own money, rather than that of the federal purse, into the rail networks to expand service. The industry did not collapse, did not need more bailouts, and freight can now compete with the truckers. Staggers was part of a larger trend, like I said, and the U.S. government continued to deregulate other forms of transportation. In 1995, the ICC was abolished, with its remaining duties transported to the U.S. Surface Transportation Board. I want to thank Ben Thompson of Stratechery for inspiring this topic. Check out his excellent podcast, Sharp Tech. In 2009, Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway paid 26% to acquire Burlington Northern Santa Fe Corp., one of the big consolidated railroad companies. They had been invested in the railroad for a while. Back in 2007, a few years earlier, Buffett's partner Charlie Munger said about it, "Now, railroads is an example of changing our minds. Warren and I have hated railroads our entire life. They're capital-intensive, heavily unionized with some make-work rules, heavily regulated and long competed with a comparable disadvantage versus the trucking industry, which has a very efficient method of propulsion, diesel engines, and uses free public roads. Railroads have long been a terrible business and have been lousy for investors. We did finally change our minds and invested." Looking back at it, government oversight of the railways certainly tamped down their power, but it didn't break their monopoly. That came from new changes in the market and the introduction of new technologies, many of which were funded by government. But when the market changed, the regulations stayed on the books, and the federal government did not think to remove them until after billions of dollars had already been invested into bailouts and nationalizations. Not everything is rosy for the freight train industry today. Some 20 or 30 years after Staggers, there are some yellow flags. For instance, rates for shippers have started to rise again after bottoming out in the early 2000s or so. New regulations, technologies, or adjustments to the market will be needed. And as for passenger high-speed rail, I guess I'll say this. Having ridden the Taiwan high-speed rail, it is a fantastic experience. It would be nice to have that in the United States. However, I doubt that similar projects in the U.S., like the California high-speed rail, are economical, because America is so huge and spread out. But I suppose that is why we do government. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.